Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, with all that cold and snow, you'd think, you know, insect conversations would be thing of the past. But no, that's not the case. There are always insects to talk about, and it's always a great pleasure to have Phil Pelletieri join us. Phil's an entomologist, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus at the UW-Madison, formerly headed the Insect Diagnostic Lab. And Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
You know, I was deer hunting last weekend, and one of the things that really interested me was the amount of insect activity around my stand.
Yeah, it's, you know, if you get out in the right situations, even in January, it's surprising what you can catch. In fact, we have a colleague of mine who prides himself in going out the nastiest weather you can find, and he's still finding insects. And you know, a lot of times it's around streams and other places. That's part of it. But we've got winter cutworms and winter snowflies, and as I said, it's really quite interesting is the creatures that can get out. Now, when it's 20 below out, no. But no. If you get these situations, you might have snow on the ground, but you get a little bit of a warm-up, and it'd be a surprise what you can wake up.
Yeah, I think we had like 20 degrees, 25 degrees, somewhere in there. There was lots of insect activity.
Yeah, this weekend on Sunday, and of course it warmed up a bit, but I was seeing moths flying, you know.
Yeah.
And so that kind of gives you an idea that things, if you get the right conditions, you can wake them up for a day or two, and then they'll go back to the slumber when the things get cold.
So even moths will fly around at that.
Yeah, in fact, there's a group of inchworms that we often refer to as winter moths, and they are often active in November, which is a time you wouldn't expect it, but that's the kind of the mating season and the like, and instead, so it isn't unusual, and you know, things hiding under bark that, again, can wake up under the right conditions at any time, and so they're out there.
And the impact, the early snow, the early cold, doesn't have much of an impact on our insects then?
Not really. The one thing that I was thinking about, so I saw more woolly bears this fall than I've seen in a long time. You know, a year ago, couldn't find one. So, you know, that's kind of how insect populations go. But what I was thinking in the southern part of the state is where the snow melted off, we got that heavy rain, it did kind of wake things up. That may cause a little problem. If there's icing and whatnot, that causes respiration problems for some insects. But generally speaking, just like the plants, most insects use day length to tell them it's time to get prepared for the winter. So they're in a life stage that would not really be affected one way or another.
And a cabin in the north, you know, which is, of course, cold. And then when you come up and heat it up, we had some Asian lady beetles. A few, not very many. This is in Bayfield County. Probably four or five I saw several days I was there.
Yeah, well, their trick is that they're just hiding in cracks and crevices. And the amazing thing is that they'll wake up within a few hours of the temperatures getting up, of you lighting the fire and warming things up. Their populations have been in decline in the state for quite some time. But, you know, I was in a couple pockets this fall where the numbers are pretty impressive. And again, the way the fall kind of strung out, I would say they were on an uptick in some places, although, again, nothing like we saw 10 years ago when they really were so problematic.
You know, a tradition for us, Emily and I, the day after Thanksgiving is the day that we always go and buy our Christmas tree, cut down our Christmas tree. And so we'll be doing that, and I'm wondering what insects might be present on that tree.
Normally we don't see a lot, but I have on a number of occasions had people send me samples, mostly of aphids. And, you know, again, it kind of depends how the fall goes, but some aphids will overwinter as eggs, other one potentially as adults under the bark. But usually what I think is we're getting an egg hatch. So you get this kind of blossoming in a couple days after bringing the tree in and warming it up. They can't survive on the tree. There's not a problem. So it's kind of a nuisance, something that maybe the vacuum cleaner is the best way to deal with it. So it's not common, but I've seen it on a number of occasions. There was a very incorrect rumor years ago that deer ticks overwintered on Christmas trees and you'd bring them in the house.
Oh.
They're down in the litter. That just isn't true. It's one of those urban legend types of things. So generally speaking, you don't worry about it. You're cutting a live tree. You know, if it had insect problems, it would not look nice enough to cut. in most cases.
There you go.
So as I said, just a few incidental needle critters once in a while, and nothing that we really have to worry about causing any problems.
And so would that be the same with firewood, or is that a different kind of situation?
Well, with firewood, you're often cutting dead trees that already have insect activity in it. So there's a whole bunch of wood borers, sometimes ants and a few other critters that you can expect to come in. Again, you'd put them pretty much in a nuisance category because they can come out, they can make a mess, but they're not going to infest anything in your home. The only exception in very well-seasoned oak firewood and hickory, there's a critter called a powder post beetle that only gets in the wood after 2 or 3 years after it's been dead. That does have the potential, if you have barn board and other open vesseled wood in the house under the right conditions, but still the chance of them successfully establishing is very remote. The conditions are just too dry in our homes to keep the insects very happy.
I'm thinking about firewood. I have some posts, some nice posts that were from our previous house that was they were from 1906. So they were in the basement from 1906 until a year ago, and I haven't burned them yet. The firewood is going to be unbelievable when you've got wood dried out like that, and it's just beautiful looking wood.
Yeah, well, it's you know, we do an old barn board at times bring some critters in the house when people are using that for remodeling, and then it gets problematic basically because the treatments, you need to cover all the surfaces, and you've already nailed it up on the wall and it's covered. But as I said, these are really more nuisance problems, nothing I would define as a structural problem where your house will fall down.
Entomologist Phil Pelletieri, our guest. You can join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post an insect photo or an insect question on our Facebook page. Title of that page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And Mike in Castle Rock, we'll turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. So every fall I get wolf spiders in the basement, and I wonder if they winter over there.
Okay.
So what's the longevity? Do they live a long time like tarantulas?
It would be possible for a wolf spider to go a couple of years. And, you know, they're a wandering spider, so, you know, wandering in is not surprising. But my gut feeling is it's a mistake unless your basement is really cool. The dilemma they run into is, you know, it being cold-blooded, their metabolism is tied into air temperature. So if they're warmed up, you'd think you're doing them a favor, but they're basically just burning off their energy reserves with not a whole lot of food available. So they're really better to be in an outside dormant situation where everything's on hold. And this is true of most insects, is coming indoors doesn't do them a favor. They
it's
basically
their death knell.
Yeah, they're basically set up to go through an extended we call it diapause, but it's a hibernation-like state. And if you get in conditions where they can stay active, as I said, it really physiologically causes all kinds of problems.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Mike. Ryan in Menominee, hello to you.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Just a quick question. I'm not sure if this is just me not paying attention or if this is just if this is something common. So I want to ask about roaches. I've lived in Wisconsin all my life. I've lived in northern Wisconsin, and I had never seen a roach. And I moved down to Menominee a few years ago, and I started seeing people with roach problems, and I started getting roach problems in my apartment. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if that was something that was common to southern Wisconsin, or was I just not paying attention when I lived up north?
So, although we do have a couple native cockroaches that live under the bark of trees, they don't come in your house. Basically, all the roaches we have indoors are not native here, but they have been domesticated, if you want to put it that way. And so, they can't live outdoors. They must live indoors. It's quite common in apartment situations, if one neighbor gets roaches and doesn't address the problem, they will go to all the other neighbors. They're also really quite common in restaurant situations, potentially, although, you know, restaurants have pest control services to deal with it. So what I tend to find, I used to tease, you know, many of our students here on campus have never been exposed to roaches until they get involved with student housing. So it's kind of an urban problem. It's an urban, you know, multifamily type problem. The one thing I'll tell you during my career that has changed is with some of the baits and whatnot, I think cockroaches are easier to control now than they used to be 20, 30 years ago. And for that reason, I guess we get less, if people follow the rules, can take care of it. unfortunately, you know, there's various things you can buy on the internet or whatnot that claim that'll drive the cockroaches out and the like. And these things don't have any science to them. They don't work. And so sometimes people don't address the problem correctly. But if you have a roach problem, you've got somebody that know what how to address it, it should be able to be cleaned up pretty easily. And again, it's kind of more of an urban thing. The bigger cities, they're more common.
Which would make sense. I grew up in the country. So,
yep.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Sally in Middleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Boy, do I appreciate this opportunity. I'm old and all my life never come across these. In my infestation, I live in Middleton, inside my house, not outside. It's full of sphinx moths.
Okay.
Where do they come from, and how on earth do I get rid of them? They're pretty little things. They have little angel wings, and but they're flying around. They aren't even particularly attracted to food.
Okay, so my first thing, sphinx moth to me is a much larger moth that's only found outdoors. I mean, they're 3 inches long and fly like a hummingbird.
Oh, no, no.
If I had to guess from your description, by far, there's two or three species of moths that we find with dry goods. So technically, bird food, dog food, cereal, nut meats, and they often come in from the grocery store. And the adult moths do not feed on the food. It's the little white caterpillars. And so commonly bring them in on one thing, but unfortunately, they're very good at finding other plant-based products in the house. And it's kind of like a detective game of figuring out where they come from. And the only way you really do solve it is to find the box or the baggie that has some, you know, almond chips or something in it. And again, think of anything that is dried plant material. So that also includes potpourri, you know, vegetable seeds. Sometimes we have art objects made out of those natural type products that can be the food source. When you hit the breeding source, you'll find little white caterpillars and usually webbing. The most common one is called the Indian meal moth, but there's a Mediterranean flower moth. There is an almond moth. So there's about four or five species, but they pretty much work the same. So you're going to have to look, and sometimes it gets tricky. I mean, in my career, a couple times we had people who just couldn't solve the problem until they were doing some remodeling, and they found out that mice had taken some dog food from years ago and stashed it back in underneath the cupboards, and that was where the breeding site was. So that's kind of the wild ones. But, you know, typically, as I said, if this has been an occurrence of the last few months, you brought something in, and if you've got any kind of bird seed, I would start with that, because they don't monitor pet food as close as they do people food for these kind of problems.
And as a matter of fact, Sally, I had the exact same problem. And I went to my bird seed, and that's where they were coming from.
Oh, and are they very little? I mean, the little white worms.
Yeah, the caterpillars, full grown, are only a half inch.
Yeah, well, and that's it. I think you got it.
Well,
I have seen them here and there.
Yeah. Well, you know, and sometimes where you find them is, you know, if they're crawling on the ceiling, it's something high in the cupboards. You know, if they're crawling on the floor, then it's maybe something under the sink. So they're not near as mobile as the adults. The adults drive you a little bit crazy because they can fly all around the house. So they show up in the bathroom or other places that just don't make sense.
Tiger and Coco, our cats, loved it because they love to hunt these moths. chase after those.
They are humbling. I've told the story before on the show that we started an infestation in some birdseed in the garage. They found their way in the cupboards. We threw a bunch of noodles and stuff out. But my problem is, even though the numbers were low, maybe two a week, this went on for months. And of course, my wife would inform me, "What kind of entomologist are you? You can't solve this." And I was just, you know, we used to have a parakeet, so I went back to the old bird cage. I mean, thinking of all the possibilities. But what it finally turned out to be is I had a True Value hardware store bag sitting on my shelf that I sure had nuts and bolts and things. It turned out it was some vegetable seeds my father-in-law had given me years ago.
Oh,
and they found that, yeah. And that was just enough to sustain a small number constantly.
There you go. So even, Sally, even the experts can sometimes get flummoxed, at least for a while. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Darlene a chance to join in. And Darlene, you soon will be able to do that. Just a reminder, our guest today, entomologist Phil Pelletieri, Distinguished Faculty Associate Emeritus, Extension with UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He retired there as its head. Our guest, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the IDS Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're learning about the world of insects with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. If you have a question for Phil, or maybe there's a photo you've got. If there's a photo that you'd like to share with us of an insect, or you want to know what it is, you can send it to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can also email us a question at talk@wpr.org. And you know what? We've got two or three phone lines open. So you can join in on the line at 1-800-642-1234. And now let's turn to Darlene and Tomahawk. Darlene, thank you for waiting.
Yes, hi. I guess I'm just sort of frustrated. I don't know if Phil is the one that can really answer this. This is regarding the emerald ash borer and people having to buy little bundles, 12 inches, 15 inches square, for $5, $8, just in order to have for campfires. And loggers can truck logs throughout the entire state and other states. I mean, it just seems to be conflicting, and the campers are paying the penalty for this little bug that's going to move regardless of campfires.
Well, you know, a couple things, you know, behind, we know from just past experience that this thing moves much quicker with human intervention than it does on its own accord. And so there are restrictions about moving firewood, and loggers have restrictions too. Now, there are ways they can kiln dry, and, you know, there are, again, certain regulations that take in some common sense here of what makes sense. But unfortunately, what I have seen is more often, again, it's people just maybe not understanding or not thinking through as being more the concern. I think loggers understand the potentials here, you know, that it will affect their livelihood. But you know, I remember before we had EAB established in Wisconsin that they were checking the ferries coming across from Michigan, of course, which is the source of this. And even with, again, all these restrictions and the like, they'd open up people's trunks, and it was not that uncommon for them to find people stashing firewood, so they didn't have to pay that extra $6 locally. And that's really what they've tried to address, is to make this a local source of wood that we know is clean, or if it's an infested county, it's not moving out of the county. And as I said, so now politics come into play in some cases. You know, there are things that come in from out of state. I know that some people would wish we didn't bring in the state because of the potential of bringing in exotic things. But for the most part, the rules that are there are here to protect us from, yeah, again, this human intervention and in human transportation.
Yeah. Thanks, Darlene, for calling. Don in Eau Claire. Hello.
Hi. Say, I was deer hunting, and so there was snow on the ground, and a little spot that was maybe 3 feet round didn't have snow, so it had melted there. And flying above this little warm area was it looked like a mosquito. Is that possible?
Yes. There's other things that look like mosquitoes that are not, but although the majority of the mosquito species that we have in the state spend the winter as eggs and then hatch in the spring when they flood, we do have one genus that overwinters as adults under bark, in tree holes, back in caves. And then again, if you get a condition that warms them up, they can be active. So, you know, we have even had mosquitoes in January. If you get a bit of a warm-up, you know, something that allows their body temperature to get up enough to fly, you can expect it anytime.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Don. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. We have an email from Todd in La Crosse. Todd says, I did not see any damage from spotted wing Drosophila on my fall-bearing raspberries in the La Crosse area. What did you see statewide for that?
I think officially they found 20 counties infested this past year. We have had 36 counties total on and off over the last two or three years, but it's still somewhat inconclusive what's happening. Are they spending the winter here, which is kind of the gut feeling that we have?
Yeah.
Or are they blowing up here and we're getting a reestablishment every year? So as I said, the verdict is still a little bit out on this. It's not really clear. Generally speaking, I would say statewide it was similar to the previous year, but it can be very patchy. That's, as I said, a very intriguing question of what's going on here. And But count your blessings, as they said, because it's unfortunately either you get it bad or you don't have it. It's one or the other. It's not an in-between.
Also, he wondered if you could discuss how the gypsy moth populations were moving or not moving this past year.
Well, the gypsy moth number seems down. In fact, that's the one thing, you know, when I look the big picture, agriculturally, there was just nothing, you know, that historic lows for European corn borer numbers. I mean, just a whole bunch of things that we usually worry about weren't doing well, which is good for the farmers. And so gypsy moth generally did not have a good year. A lot of that has to do with the spring weather and the like. You know, we've had a lot of natural diseases tend to help us out. We still got some hot pockets, and that's why the DNR and the Department of Ag do their survey work to see of areas that may need spraying. But generally speaking, again, it was another down year for gypsy moth because of the spring weather. And to some degree, what helped us up north was the extreme cold, because the eggs that get exposed to these minus 25 and more, there's high mortality. Unfortunately, the ones that are insulated underneath the snow survive, so it's not as if we can totally wipe them out. But, you know, what hurts us with gypsy moth is very dry springs. That's when the caterpillars have a much higher success.
Yeah. Roger in Park Falls has a comment for us. Roger, hi. Thank you for calling.
In reference to that woman that called up about the loggers don't have to comply with any transportation of in case of ash borer infestation, we have to. Yes. The mills will require you to have a ticket if you're salvaging this kind of material. And they keep track of this. Still, and if there's infestation in a county, they'll quarantine that county.
And won't let you transport out of it then.
They'll let you transport out of it, but there's a paper trail of what's happening.
Okay.
It's similar to what the gypsy moth quarantines. What they've got going on there, they got the ticket, and if you got wood that's in this county, they don't believe transport it at certain times of the year.
Ah, okay, that makes sense. Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the information. And Annette in Madison has something for us. Annette, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, I am calling about, two questions, but they're both about the same things. My main concern is about pollinators, honeybees, and native pollinators. And I know that there is an insecticide that people are using or will be using on their ash trees in Wisconsin. And I believe it's systemic, but in any event, I'm wondering what effect that is going to have on pollinators, honeybees, native pollinators.
Yeah.
And also the other concern I have, which is a significant concern, is the use of neonicotinoids. Monsanto, I think, has a lot of its seeds are filled with neonicotinoids, and that's going to kill off our pollinators, I believe. At least the evidence looks that way. So I'm just wondering what you have to say about those things.
Sure. Thanks, Annette.
It's like so many things in science. It's a kind of a complicated story, but let's start with the ash situation. The product is a neonicotinoid in many cases, and it's systemic, but what buffers our pollinators in this situation is ash is not a plant that bees work, and they don't get exposed. And one of the interesting things about the neonicotinoids is they do not translocate, if you make a general statement, very well into flowers. And for that reason, they can be in the leaves, and the only thing that is affected is something that eats the leaves, and pollinators don't do that. Now, what complicates the story in cropping systems when they use these products as seed treaters isn't so much the exposure by the small amount of insecticide on a seed to a plant that's going to flower 60 days from now, and it would be really quite dilute. What's been turned out to be more of the environmental headache is the powders are often that are on these seeds are blowing on the surface when things are planted. This dust is now impregnated with insecticide, and that's where a lot of the pollinators were getting exposure. And so I will tell you that EPA is going through a review of this group of chemicals. I would highly suspect we're going to see its uses restricted because of pollinator concerns, but it differs by crop. And so I'll give you an example, even with the trees. So I mentioned that I don't see a lot of exposure to native pollinators to ash treatments. But if you treated a linden tree, which, of course, flowers in the middle of summer, is highly attractive to bees, then you start to get a situation, say, you know, there might be
a
potential here. And so I think those are the kind of changes you're going to see, is that if there are situations where there is undue exposure, they're going to take that use away. And as I said, much like in the agricultural system, where they're going now is finding other ways of getting this product on the seed so that we're not contaminating dust that's blowing all over and getting on other plants and getting on the bees themselves. And as I said, so you have to look in somewhat detail to see where the problems lie, rather than the blanket statement that just because we're using neonicotinoids, the bees are getting exposed.
So there we go. Thank you, Annette, for calling and raising that. Appreciate your call. We have Dan in Door County next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I wanted to share an experience about how difficult these pantry moths can really be. I was remodeling a home last year and opened up the walls in the kitchen, and the mice had gotten in there and stored beans and nuts and anything they could find laying loose in the kitchen. And then the mice had moved on and left a stash there, and the pantry moths took over, and there was a substantial nest and larvae present. And, you know, even if you think you cleaned your whole house out, they could be in between the walls.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. And you know, when I sit with my colleagues, we often come up with nightmare stories. And one I remember in the lab is a person who was living out in a rural area, fed 2 tons of birdseed a year, loved birds, had lots of bird feeders. His walls were stashed 5 feet high, all the void spaces filled with birdseed.
Ah!
And again, the problem is how do you solve that problem? I mean, technically, you would have to rip everything off, clean everything out between every one of the wall voids and what's not practical. I mean, it really was a non-stoppable problem because you had unlimited food source for the moths and they weren't accessible. So I know exactly what you're saying, that you can get these sometimes riddles. And, you know, and again, you move into a house and the problem was the previous owner had a mouse problem 10 years ago, and it took the moths 10 years to finally find that food stash. But once they find it, they're happy.
One other update, too, on the moths outside. I was walking the dogs on the golf course in the state park on Sunday and saw several moths coming out of the edge of the woods.
Yeah,
very cool.
They're alive and well. They had a little bit of a warm spell, though, too.
Thanks, Dan.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. Oh, man. Well, we got a photo up on our Facebook page. Here's something from listener Jenny in Chicago. Says, although not outdoors technically, check out this spider. It's taken up residence in our garage window. We assume she came in with the lumber. Is it a brown recluse, do you reckon?
Yeah, it is not, but it's a close lookalike. It's the most common spider I see sent in the lab to be potentially a recluse. It's a funnel weaver. An agalenid is the fancy group. Very common out in shrubbery, in other places. They make a funnel-like retreat that they live in. It's about the size and the rough coloration of a recluse. And that's why, again, with if you're not used to looking at spiders, it's easy to make the mistake, but definitely not to worry about that. The recluse is basically a light tan body with a black violin on the cephalothorax, the front end. The other thing, and most people don't get this close, but the ultimate thing is recluse only has 6 eyes, and almost every other spider you run into has 8. So if you can get a magnifying glass and take a peek, that's often a way to separate it. And, you know, there are recluse in Chicago. They're not common. It's still considered north of the normal range, which is about central Illinois.
Here's another interesting Facebook photo from our Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And it's from Gene, who says, I took this last July on a street in Madison. I've never seen anything like this one before. Who are those?
Okay, so we have 2 different sized flies. Now, the first thing one might wonder is that the male and female are different and we're having a mating going on, but that's not the case here. The large creature is called a robber fly, and robber flies are predators. And so it's basically caught looks like probably a flesh fly as its prey. And robber flies can be very impressive, upwards of a couple inches long. you know, very quick
cool
moving
picture.
Yeah, it's a very neat picture. And there is a great site, the Robber Flies of Wisconsin. If you, they're not the easiest to identify because there's so many different species. They're not the easiest to photograph because they're very active insects. But you might consider going to that site and taking a look to see if you can get a species ID on it. But neat critters.
Yeah, very neat critters. Thanks very much for sending those photos. You can do it too, by the way. If you've got a neat insect photo, go to our Facebook page. The Larry Mealer Show is the title of it, and post your photo there. We have an email from John in Iowa, wonders if you could talk about the native bee houses that people are starting to make now. I'd like to hear more about it. It sounds like it'd be a great winter project for people who would like to make one.
Oh, yes. And, you know, the bee that gets probably the best press is the orchard mason bee. And a lot of people construct houses for mason bees because they're quite active in the spring. They're a neat native pollinator. But there are literally dozens of species of bees that will use this environment. And the other day I was doing a search under bee hotel, and I got these exquisite pictures of basically bee condominiums is the only way to explain it. And what the people were doing is realizing that many of the species of bees utilize various size holes in wood, in particular, old wood borer holes and the like. Other ones use the pith of inside plants that are like straws, hollow stems. And so what this bee hotel had is a beautiful multiple different sized holes in pieces of log, bundles of straw, bundles of soft pith plants, and putting this all together and basically providing different sized holes for different species of bees. You know, this is one of the reasons our native bees have problems is that because of habitat destruction, there aren't these wild areas with dead logs and other things for them to be in. And so that's the whole idea of supporting these bee houses. So the standard for mason bee is 3/8 inch diameter and about 3 inches deep. But as I said, you can make bigger holes, you can make smaller holes. There's also some parasitic wasps or predator wasps that we use those kind of environments. So I said with a little bit of internet search, you'll have all kinds of things. And the interesting thing, this one site, it was almost artistic the way the people had set up these bee condominiums. And as I said, and they were looking for multiple species rather than just concentrating on one, which I think is a good idea.
So you typed in or you Googled in
bee hotel.
Bee hotel.
And just look for images, and I said it will pop up. I can't remember the exact name of the site. I apologize for that. But I was incredibly impressed, both the amount of work that somebody had done, and it really was well-based in biology, and as I said, but it also turned out to be very attractive. And they had even built a little canopy house on the top to protect it a little bit from the elements. So as I said, you can get a lot of good ideas there.
Joe in Franklin up next. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm calling in regards to the cockroaches. I found out that just by chance that the cold really killed them. You know, we used to have them as pets. And as kids, we used to crawl out the windows and stuff and forget to close the windows. And then during the winter, we would find them just laying all over the floor.
Yeah, well, it turns out that, again, the cockroaches that we have in our homes and like are tropical species. And so they do have some limitations as far as what they can tolerate as far as cold. Although, you know, if you put them at 40 degrees, they can stay dormant for a very long period of time and then kind of wake up. But when you start to get around freezing in the such, which is a trick that can be used at times if you have, you know, items that are infested, is put them in the freezer for 3 or 4 days. And as I said, the one thing about using cold to kill insects, it's the shock, it's the sudden change that's really more important than it is, because if you give insects a chance to slowly, gradually change the temperature, they have a much better chance of surviving.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you for calling, Joe. Nathan in Jefferson, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hey, Phil. I just wanted to give you my count of what I collected up hunting last weekend up in Florence County. And it wasn't too cold up there, I guess, but lots of snow. I ended up finding about 7 orders and 12 different species up there. Didn't get a deer, though.
Well, unfortunately. That shows you, again, if you know what you're looking for, there is just a bunch of interesting things. And you know, everything from what people call snow fleas, which are springtails that you can find out at times. And that's impressive, though. I honestly, if you were to tell me you're going to Florence County and, by the way, I'm going to look for insects, I would not have come up with that high a number of diversity in particular.
Well, I thought the lacewing and the firefly were probably the more impressive ones to be crawling around in the snow.
Oh, firefly. That one really surprises me. That really does.
It's one of the kind that doesn't light up.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Thanks, Nathan.
Thank you.
There's a guy that goes deer hunting to count insects and look up different insects.
Well, you know, sometimes the hunting's slow, so you have to keep yourself amused. And so I very much appreciate that.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Nathan. Ruth in Eagle River. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have some little flies that have been driving me nuts. They're really tiny, like about smaller than a sesame seed. They're black and with clear wings, and my daughter looked on her internet, and she said that they might be like drain flies or something, but mm-hmm. they do seem to bite also, and they like to fly in your face all the time. I don't know what to do. I didn't have any Drano or anything. I put bleach down in the drains a little bit, and it didn't seem to do much good, but how do I get rid of them?
Okay, so there's still three or four possibilities, to be honest. But the biting part is one that doesn't add up, because I don't know of any indoor breeding flies that are true biters. Now, the first thing I would suggest at the small size is they could be fungus gnats. And fungus gnats will breed in houseplant potting soil or other sources of wet organic matter. It has to have some moisture.
Sense. That makes sense, because I have a lot of plants, and they do hang around by the plants.
Okay. So then... there are things that you can get at the hardware store or more probably a plant store for treating the soil of indoor house plants. One of the more common things is a bacteria. So it's pretty much for people a non-toxic thing that you put in the soil. And when the maggots get exposed to this bacteria, they'll die, and that will cut down the population. So, one of the other options is to get rid of the plants. But most people that have plants in the house would rather have the plants and just... as I said, make the adjustments to deal with it. But they're breeding, again, in the organic matter in the potting soil. And fungus gnats are really small. Most of the other drain flies, there's a moth fly that we get that is kind of fuzzy. And I wouldn't expect it around the plants. There is a forid fly that we see sometimes. I will tell you, though, when we have to treat drains, bleach doesn't do anything. All it does is sterilize the inside of the drain coating, but it doesn't cut through. So if you have something that potentially is breeding and that kind of stuff, you need something that's going to eat through the slimy gook. And so there are biological enzyme drain cleaners and other things that are a better direction to go if indeed that's the source. But as I said, I'm much more suspicious your critters are coming from your houseplant soil.
Okay, so do you know what kind of stuff I should put down in there, or just go to the store and ask them? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, you've got to read the label. Again, the product I know under is Gnat Out is one of the names of it. A Knockout is another one. But there's the problem with the labeling of stuff in the stores is sometimes something can have one name and could be potentially three different things, so it gets confusing. But you need something for killing fungus gnats in potting soil. And that's why I think rather than a hardware store that typically has stuff more for your vegetable garden or for spraying ants in the house, it's better to go to a plant store, because this is not an uncommon problem in greenhouses and foliage plants. And for that reason, they often will have some stuff for treating the soil.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison, our guest today as we talk bugs with him. The Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Phil Pelletieri, entomologist extraordinaire, and we're talking with him about the world of insects here in Wisconsin. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. We have Mark in Madison up next with a question or comment. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was curious about praying mantises in Wisconsin. This past summer while I was at work, out on the patio, we found a praying mantis and he was pretty impressive. He was probably 6 to 8 inches in length, very green. And I had never seen one in Wisconsin before. I was wondering how prevalent they are in Wisconsin.
So they're not native, and although you occasionally would see one, up until about 10 years ago or so, we did not consider them breeding in the state because the egg cases would freeze out. But that has changed.
Okay.
And so both in Iowa and parts of Minnesota and Wisconsin, we know we've got breeding populations. We figure the southern third of the state. One of the big questions about the winter of last year, was it cold enough to freeze them out? And you've got a strong piece of evidence is no, it was not. So, again, if you're an old guy like me growing up here, they were very rare, but now they become moderately common. And again, in the Madison area, I would see a lot of samples. People would send me pictures or call up about it. And as I said, so I think they're here to stay. Even though they're not native, they're an interesting creature, beneficial to a point. You know, they don't eat all the pests that are out there, but and they'd eat a butterfly as likely as they would a cabbage worm. But they're neat critters, and kids identify very well with them, so I like to have them around.
Are they considered invasive at all?
Well, hypothetically, yes, because they're not native, but because they're a beneficial insect, they're considered acceptable. And so, as I said, they're really kind of, in the scheme of things, neutral because you can't concentrate them. They're cannibalistic. There's a whole bunch of reasons why you can't have 50 of them in your backyard at one time. But as far as prey, they are more likely to feed on larger things like grasshoppers and things like that, and not so much some of the little pests that we have like spider mites and aphids. So,
interesting. Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks, Mark, for calling. Appreciate it. We have a call from Suzanne in Mequon. Hi, Suzanne.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about mason bees.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a place where I can purchase them, mason bees that are specifically native to Wisconsin?
So most of the commercial native or mason bee producers are up in the Pacific Northwest. To be honest, the species they have out there that's commonly sold to people is the same one we have here.
Okay.
If there's none in the area, I think my first take at it is to make a mason bee house and see if some show up, because they are native. We do. In fact, we have, I think, 4 species in that genus, Osmia, in the state. And so it's you and more providing the right habitat, and they will come, especially if you've got wooded areas and, you know, kind of diverse habitat around you. Now, if you're in a suburbia that's a new development that used to be a cornfield, that's not good habitat. And in that situation, you might consider having to import some to kind of get them started.
Mm. There you go.
Okay. You were talking about a mason bee hotel earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something I need to look for that would make one manufacturer or somebody who makes mason bee houses better than another?
Not really. I mean, basically what they're providing is either straws or drill holes in a piece of wood that are 3/8 of an inch in diameter. So that's the size that the bees are looking for. And then usually 4 or 5 inches deep. And so there's just a number of ways of doing that. As I said, so you don't even have to buy houses.
You can make
them yourselves if you got a drill in a block of wood. So
I'd rather buy them.
Okay. Yeah, and you
there
can.
You
can buy bee houses, and as I said, you can buy bee houses. What they will ship you are ones that have developing larvae inside, you know, so they're collected. That's how they get through the winter, and then when they wake up in the spring, they'll cut their way out, and they're off in out and about. One of the problems, though, is those houses need to be cleaned out in order for them to come back. But in fact, I've seen some interesting designs that have that kind of clean-out built into them, so you can take them apart.
Okay.
You know, and clean them out and go from there.
So look for that maybe when you're looking to
yeah,
purchase.
Or the real inexpensive paper straw ones, you know, that
okay.
they're you
just
don't have as much invested.
Yeah.
So if I do purchase bees now, this is a good time to do it?
Well, typically they'll ship them in the spring.
Okay.
You know, yeah, so it'd be kind of a pain to store them correctly right now. So as I said, that's something I would think about in February and kind of get on it and have them shipped from there. So.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate the call. And back to our Facebook page. Let's go back to the Larry Mueller Show. I pulled this up a few minutes back, and I've been looking at all the different things. Cheryl sent us a photo of, she says, what kind of spider is this? I see many in mailboxes.
Okay, so this is, first of all, a female orb weaver. I can tell because of the distended abdomen. And by nature, they're a late summer spider, and there's a number of species. In fact, the black and yellow Argiopa garden spider comes to this group. This one is either in the genus Araneus or Dictonia, I think, is the other genus. One of the problems with these guys is that they're quite variable in color, even for the same species. And so they're kind of hard to give people a species name of it. But if you look orb weaver, again, you can probably, if you go through a big enough database, find something that will fit it. But very colorful, very harmless, and make great photographic subjects, I think, in most cases, because of the neat color patterns on the abdomen.
Cheryl sends another one, too, a greenish.
Okay, so this is a crab spider, but in particular, it's a subgroup that are often called flower spiders, because these flower crab spiders often are camouflaged so they can sit in white and yellow flowers, and they wait there for gnats and bees and other things to come, and they will come to feed on it. So, again, some have pink markings. This one looks like it might be one of those that have some of the interesting pink on white or pink on yellow markings. So very unusual color for a spider, but it makes a lot of sense where you think where they want to sit in ambush looking for prey.
And finally, a third one that we have here, the sign of a bright green.
Yeah, it's lunchtime, it looks like. So this is looks like Anax junius, which is the big green downer dragonfly, and it appears that it's chewing on something, and these guys are predators. So you often, if you watch one that's resting, you'll see its little front legs going up to its mouth. It's usually holding some kind of gnat or other creature that it's caught. Neat picture.
Yeah, really, really neat photos. And thanks for sending them. I want to go to Don in Warren, Illinois next. Don, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Last summer, Phil, you were talking about yellow jackets. I'm an amateur beekeeper, and about Labor Day, the yellow jackets start robbing the honeybees. And sometimes it gets so bad, they just strip everything out. And they'll operate at a much cooler temperature. And they just devastate the bees. And I have tried everything. The yellow jacket traps, but what you said last summer triggered something in me. You said that somebody thought they had a trap that was baited properly. And then you said that these yellow jackets fixate on a product. So I go get a 2-liter bottle of orange soda, the cheapest you can buy, and made an open container, covered to the weather, but open to the bees, and start pouring it in. And the yellow jackets never went near the beehives. They sucked up the orange pop to the point of 2 liters a day. And after they got into it real good, I started putting out the traps. And it solved the problem, and I had no idea. So it worked this time. I don't know if it'll work next year. But to get started early enough and get them suckers zeroed in on orange pop, orange soda, that eliminated the problem.
Well, I'm glad it worked. What you might expect, just the way the yellow jacket colonies build, is very early. Both their numbers are low and the food is very readily available, so they have no interest. It's when they make this transition where they have a lot of mouths to feed and food becomes in short supply, they start to be scavengers. And I think that's that late summer push that you've seen. I know many of the people in the pest control industry have told me Mountain Dew is a very good product, too, to attract them. And I do not have stock in that company, so I am. It's interesting how they habituate. Now, you know, what people have looked for, is there something we could put in the pop so when they go back and feed each other, that would work? But then you've got this problem again that if you've got non-targets like bees that might be working the pop, so that really has not been developed to a point where there's commercially available product where you're using a poison taken back to the nest versus what you're doing in this case is giving them something they prefer to your honeybees and you kind of take the pressure off. But I'm glad you shared that with me because, as I said, it's a It's an interesting group that, in particular, the German yellow jacket, which is often our biggest problem of the yellow jackets, a ground nester, caused devastating problems to New Zealand when it got there to their bee industry for the same reason. It's a competitor, and it's stealing the honey, and the bees need the honey. And as I said, so it has, this is not unusual to have this kind of conflict.
Thanks, Don. Appreciate the call. And Diane in Norfolk, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, I will be traveling to Central America soon, and I'm concerned about bed bugs and perhaps other bugs that you might not know about. But I was wondering if you could give me some advice before I leave. What can I take along to help the problem? Are they repelled by DEET?
No.
DEET
doesn't work. I didn't make the national meetings, but my colleagues tell me that there are some research going on, some very interesting repellents, but it's a ways away before they will make the market. So it's kind of a physical protection is what I would advise you. Is the biggest chance of bringing them home is on things like your suitcase and the like. So if you can store your suitcase in places that you don't find bedbugs very easily, like the tub in a bathroom, that's a great place to put it. Other people will bring plastic bags for their suitcase so that, you know, when they take their clothes out, they'll seal the suitcase up and then seal it in a plastic bag and wrap it up so that the bed bugs don't have a chance to get into the seams. And when you come back, the option is there are treatments that can be done. And typically there are some pest strips that you can get on the internet that, again, can be put in a confined situation like a plastic bag or a plastic container, and you're basically fumigating and killing them.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist friend, with us until 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Phil. You stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. So happy to have you with us as we talk the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and he recently retired, of course, as head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him? Our lines are all filled. The number is 800-642-1234. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or question there, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Karen in Kewaskum has something for us, so let's go to her. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a yellow jacket question. I have a friend who's collecting 4 to 5 per night on the second floor of her home. And they are very large. They're larger than a bald-faced hornet. And I was looking for information on possibly where to look for the source. The lower part of the house is heated about 75. The second part, and it is just one room, is kept cooler. And they've checked the attic. There's nothing up there. But I was always under the impression that yellow jackets were ground dwellers. And these are very large. They're over an inch long.
Okay. I'm a little bit, you know, bald-faced is the biggest true yellow jacket paper wasp that we have in the state. You know, typically their nests are exposed so that you can see them. Now, there are other yellow jackets like German yellow jacket that will nest in void. So they could be in between a wall in a space that wouldn't be available. But what happens is that by the 1st of November, the colony has starved to death. Now, the new queens have to overwinter. And what my guess is, and this explains a little bit on the size, because the queens are bigger, is you've got overwintering queens that are still waking up because it's warm. But what's quite unusual is although you might produce, let's say, 40 or 50 queens from a nest, they usually disperse. They fly elsewhere. So it's a little odd to have, at this time of the year, such a consistent number. It does have to run its course. As I said, there's no way that they're reproducing. When it really gets cold, they're not going to be able to be active. But I think it might be worth, if they can get either a pretty good picture and send it to the diagnostic lab and let PJ take a look, or send a specimen just to verify the species. But it has to be. As I said, the only larger species that we've got is a cicada killer, And that has nothing to do with paper wasps. It lives in the ground. There's no way you'd find them at this time of the year. So that part doesn't fit. I mean, the activity does fit the pattern of queen species of yellow jackets, whatever species it might be. But as I said, to have that number, where I've had this complaint before is people that are doing remodeling and they have walls that are open. So there's lots of places for them to get up into that there. We've had some problems with consistent numbers. The other possibility is the Polistes paper wasp. Same kind of thing, though. They'd have to be queens. They'd have to be nesting up underneath things, and it should run its course pretty quick. So I wouldn't be too worried, but if we can solve the riddle, there might be an idea of what we need to plug in the future to prevent them from getting access so that this is not a common late fall, early winter problem.
Sure. Thanks, Karen, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to go back to our Facebook page because of this fantastic photo that we've got up here from Bob, who said, since several callers brought up the subject of roaches, I just wanted to show off one of my favorite bugs, the giant cave roach, Blaptica gigantus, a very elegant bug, if I do say so myself. And here's a photo of this huge bug right on Bob's mug, right on his face here. The only problem I have had with these is that they have to be kept warm when they escape from the heated terraria. Sometimes on cold winter nights, they find my way into my bed and snuggle up to me. If I'm not aware they are there, I may roll over on them and squash them accidentally. Then I have a big mess of throbbing bug
goop.
But he does enjoy taking them into his favorite establishments and convincing folks that they are experiencing delirium.
Bob has a good sense of humor. I'm glad he told me the species because I didn't recognize it at first with the color patterns. And it's interesting, a number of the tropical roaches have become quite common in the pet trade. And they do make good pets. They, as he had said, they really don't have the opportunity to breed in your house unless you provide this very nice tropical environment for them to breed and feed them properly and the like. And it's not everybody's pet, but I do know many people say that they're a great pet. They don't make a lot of noise. They don't eat a lot, you know. And
well, it's quite the photo. Listen, as you listen today, go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't even have to be a member to go to the page and take a look at his photo of this big old roach right on his face, and it's a big one.
You can't get much larger than that. So
no. Kathy in Boston, thanks a lot for calling. Hello.
Hi. I live in a log house, and I, for about 10 years, have had a problem with Asian beetles that look like ladybugs, and I have an exterminator, quite expensive every year, and this year, again, I still have them in the winter. Mm-hmm. What else can I do?
Well, you know, every year is a new invasion. And in particular, there's one of two options. They start coming in usually sometime in October, and either you have to have things sealed tight enough that they can't find a way in, which in a log home is going to be very difficult, or it has to be sprayed properly. And spraying means both covering almost every square inch on the outside, and the timing has to be correct. And the problem is if they come too early, the spray can break down before the critters come in, or if they come too late and there's ones that have already squeezed in between the logs, you can't kill them. So I would have a discussion with your pest control industry. Now, to be fair, you know, if they kill 90%, that's considered success, and the 10% that get by is just, it's not humanly possible to get every one. But if you feel that the numbers are really quite high, as I said, I would have a conversation on why they didn't think that you got what I would consider adequate control. And as I said, it's this window between 1st of October and the 1st of November, typically. Sometimes you can get them trickling a little bit earlier. What the trigger seems to be is the good hard freeze, and then you get a warm-up afterwards, tells them to start coming in, and that's when they're going to start invading the house.
Yeah.
But going back to my other comment is, if you've got the builder you worked with or you've got a friend that's a builder, you know, getting out a caulking gun and just basically getting through every crack and crevice makes a big difference. And what I tell people is, if you can solve that riddle of where they're squeezing in and prevent them from getting access, then you don't need
that's
to spray.
It. Yeah, then you don't need to spray. Kathy, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Eric and Madison, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about insect behavior, and specifically maybe tropical wasp behavior. About 15 years ago, Larry, you sent me down to Trinidad and part of an exchange program, and I was doing some field work, and we came across some, I guess, for lack of a better term, mud wasps that were underneath some leaves of the heliconia plant. And when we were hacking our way through the brush or the understory, they swarmed up and hit me about a dozen times right around my eyes. And I'm wondering if there's any sort of evolutionary, reason, like if they were doing that. I mean, they didn't hit me anywhere else, but they mm-hmm. it was right around my eyes. So my face swelled up right around my eyes, and or if that, if they focus in on eyes, or if that was just a fluke. It was just kind of a weird thing.
Well, I don't think I've ever read any papers that have exactly talked, but your comment about was this an evolutionary design? I mean, if you want to get an animal's attention, you attack the face. And what I've noticed around here with bald-faced hornets is they often seem to go to the forehead. And I think it may be because it's a heat-generating area, probably, one of the warmest parts of your body. And so I've always speculated that that's what's going on, is that it makes sense to them to go after a place that's going to get the best bang for the buck. And again, the hot area like the face. And so that's, it seems a very similar kind of behavior, is they're attacking up high on the head and don't waste their time in going into cooler places that might be covered and protected with clothing.
Yeah, interesting. Eric, good to hear your voice. Again, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call. Yeah, we had a student exchange program with the University of the West Indies. I got started a long time ago, and Eric was one of the students who went on that program. Nice place to go in January when it's...
Yes, I was always jealous when you were getting off. I remember.
pretty cold here, but it's usually around 85 there in January. So it was great to hear Eric's voice again. And Harry in Crawford County, your turn. Hi, Harry.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. Quick question about gnats. This summer we had quite an abundance of gnats on the farm, making it a little bit nasty working outside, which is, of course, what you do. And I wonder, where do they breed? Mm-hmm. Short of getting some pet cockroaches to control them.
Yeah. well, this one, unfortunately, is not something you can manipulate well, because the most common biting gnat we have are called black flies. And black flies breed in streams and rivers. And so there's very little you can do to the source of where they're coming from. And then when you get a hatch, sometimes you can find them miles away. So, a little bit on how the wind blows, but basically the source may not be available. And even if it is available, there really is not much you can practically do, unfortunately. Now, their numbers do ebb and flow, and if you've been in that area for a number of years, and this is one of the few years they've been bad, count yourself lucky. Unfortunately, I know people that are the other side of it, that, they're close to a river or a stream. So, you expect more of this in the western side of the state than the eastern side of the state, just because of the geology. And, it's an annual occurrence. And for 2 or 3 weeks, you have to take some kind of personal protection if you're outside, or you get chewed on pretty good, unfortunately. And as I said, it comes to that you can't manipulate their breeding site, which is the theory you'd use on most critters as far as trying to control them.
Sure. Okay, sounds good.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we'll turn to, let's go to Amy in New Berlin. Hi, Amy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So last Monday, I've got a 6-year-old boy and a 3-year-old boy found a woolly bear caterpillar in a puddle by our house. And they convinced me that he should come live inside before the snow started falling. So just wondering what I should do with this little fella for the winter.
So you are not doing him a favor by keeping him warm.
I didn't think so.
Right. What woolly bears do is they crawl under a rock or some other shelter to spend the winter. And then after the cold shock has told them the winter has come, in the spring, they'll spin a cocoon and the moth will come out. So you have that opportunity, but you have to get a cold shock. So, one of the options is put them in a container and keep them in the refrigerator all winter. But just as easy as, again, put it in some kind of container that you can keep it confined. Put it out in the garage or some other heated place. And then let it go through the natural warm-up in the spring, and then the timing will be right on top of it. But as I said, to keep it at 70 degrees, it will die in a couple weeks, basically because it's burning up its energy reserves, rather than, again, if you put it in a cool situation, it will stay dormant and then properly develop.
So I could just cut off this food supply, put them in the garage, and then go get them.
Yeah, I think it's good to put it, whether you put a bunch of tissue paper or, you know, bark mulch, some kind of place it can crawl into and the like, and kind of settle down. And as I said, and you're really helping it out if you're putting it in the garage or someplace else, because you're protecting it somewhat from the, you know, wind and other elements. But I would like to see it at a temperature below 40 degrees if possible, and even zero is fine.
Okay.
So
there you go.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. Email from Sarah. I have an apartment in a lovely old factory building on a river. The only problem is a crazy amount of centipedes. We keep our place spotless. Mm-hmm. We spray, we vacuum everything. With winter now, they come through the drains. Anything I can do to eliminate or help the issue? I'm already dreading the spring, knowing we get an average of 6 prehistoric-looking monsters every day.
Wow. Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it is. In part of it, centipedes are relatively slow to breed, and they're predators. And so if you get a lot of centipedes, they're finding a whole heck of a lot of food to keep those kind of populations going. And, you know, what is hard in old buildings is you've got wall voids and spaces that are not attainable. And so even if people try serious pest control, you can't really eliminate them. I mean, and also this being cold-blooded, you know, if they're in a cold place, they're dormant. And then when it warms up, as she mentions, that's when the activity picks up. Although they do respond somewhat to sprays, I think a lot of people have gone to more of these sticky glue board type traps that you put out. And if the centipede crawls on it, it gets caught. And so that would be something. The other thing is to look around. Although they may be hanging out in the drain, I doubt that they're coming up through the drain, because that plumbing system, I think, should be more closed and not give them access. It does help to reduce clutter. It does help to dry things to some degree. But again, you can't do that to all wall spaces. But the other thing is look at if there are cracks in your baseboards, in your moldings and whatnot. Those are places I would look to kind of seal up and basically try to cut access. So if they're in the walls, try to keep them in the walls rather than give them free access to come out. So wherever they've been most active, maybe that might give you some direction where you need to concentrate most of your potential adjustments to see if you can kind of slow them down somewhat.
Here's an interesting question from Jeff, who says, how long a vacation would I have to take before bed bugs back home would starve? In other words, how often do they have to eat?
Well, a number of studies, it depends on the populations, but usually a long time. You know, there are some studies that suggest as much as a year or more, although generally speaking, I'm saying 9 months.
Oh.
You know, so it really is not practical in most cases. And, you know, right now, the heat treatments are still probably the most reliable treatments, but they are expensive to get somebody to come in and do the heat treatments. And, again, it's a big challenge that we do not see going away in the short run. And it's interesting. Again, I was talking to our chairman, Dave Hogg, about a paper that he had heard. That one of the better researchers is Mike Potter down in Kentucky. And Mike gave a presentation at the entomological meetings this past month where he was discussing, you know, if you go back 500 years, bed bugs were an atrocious problem. It's only been in the last 40 years or so that we have been blessed with slowing the stinkers down.
Yeah.
And of course, that has changed now with some of the pesticide resistance and whatnot. And so this is the norm, is what his argument is, not where we were back in the 70s and 80s, where bed bugs were really quite infrequent. So part of this, again, is culturally, we're going to have to adjust. We already have made adjustments that, you know, when you buy a new mattress, they're not going to take your old mattress very likely because of the potential of transporting bed bugs. So we're making some changes to make life a little harder. I think you're going to see designs in furniture and other things to make them less suitable for bedbugs to hide in, which is much like the furniture was back in the 20s and 30s, where things were designed. There was no seams and other hiding places, and it made it easier to deal with the bed bugs, kind of force them out in the open so you could take care of them. So, as I said, you will continue to see things, and you know.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'll be interesting to see how they redesign mattresses, for example. Then.
Well, you know what they do is they put the mattress covers on them. You know,
that's
very similar to the allergy type covers,
yeah.
Except the zippers are small enough that the little baby bed bugs can't get out from. And so that's a way of taking that individual mattress out of the environment for bed bugs to breed in. And if ones are in there, they're trapped, they can't get out, and they will eventually starve.
Sylvia in Appleton. Hi, Syl. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you for the show. I bought a bee hotel at a rummage sale a couple years ago, and they were using it. There was a slat behind I have it against the garage. They had crawled behind there and started using it there and then built some on the outside and cut the smaller holes. I also made one. I used the dried stems from that horrible invasive of Japanese knotweed, and I cut them down and I tied them together. And unfortunately, somebody tore that apart. I don't know if it was the red squirrel or if one of the woodpeckers got at it, but they might have been using that. I have a question on the spiders. I just have not been seeing spiders lately. Argiopes. I haven't seen an argiope in several years, and I go out looking for them.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the local places you are. I mean, there are times that people will send me pictures that there are just orb weavers everywhere. I mean, in fact, they make some great. You get a nice dew-filled morning in the webs, or you can take some incredible
beautiful
pictures. I'm not sure, you know, what's going on of why, you know, you're at a lack of it. But generally speaking, I have seen no trends to suggest that their numbers are suffering. Again, if you've got some diversity of habitat, which is what so many of these critters need to do well in, so.
Mm-hmm. I've had Cyclopsychnatus for several years, and then all of a sudden, the last two or three, I have not been able to find a single one in my yard.
Yeah.
Along with the orb weavers, the barn spiders. Now,
yeah. Well, you know, the one thing I guess perspective-wise as I look at my career that is, you know, the ebb and flow is just really quite intriguing to me. You know, is ecologically is you know, that with insects and spiders, you often have to take a 10 or 12 year snapshot to get a true idea of where their numbers are rather than on a shorter term type of thing. Because, as I said, their populations can fluctuate. And, you know, for a lot of situations, we don't know exactly what the triggers are. I mean,
yeah.
Some cases we do, but more often than not, we're guessing. So,
yep, there you go. Thank you, Syl, for calling. I appreciate it very much. Connie at Williams Bay has heard that Osage apple is a natural spider deterrent. So she's looking at kind of deterrent.
So it's a partial truth. So Osage orange is a fruit of a tree that grows south of us. And it's big, at, you know, 3 inches in diameter and kind of gnarly on the outside. If you extract the oils that are in there, it has some insect repellency, but it's very short distance. What I have seen done is people will sell the whole Osage orange and say, if you put it in your kitchen, all the spiders are going to leave, and that's not true.
Not
so as
happen.
I said, it's true that there are some components in there that have some spider repellency, but you have to grind them up and spray them and whatnot rather than using it. So generally, I'd say no.
So no, it is. Boy, we have, here we are, went through, I don't even know how many calls we had today, but there were a lot of calls. Phil, it's always a pleasure. You've got a great Thanksgiving ahead of you.
Yeah, we have family coming over, and hopefully we'll have leftover turkey because Phil loves leftover turkey. So.
I'm with you. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit, Phil. Thank you. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus and at the UW-Madison, headed up the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, associated and a member of UW Extension for many a year. Tomorrow we have a rebroadcast for you to enjoy. We'll start with a fascinating conversation that we had with Will Russell about his book, Rare Birds of North America. Then at 11:45, we'll revisit our chat with Errol Fuller about the demise 100 years ago of the passenger pigeon. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.